Hello again, I'm Armin Alny. With Russian-backed separatists advancing in Ukraine, there is pressure on the Obama administration to provide the government with weapons sophisticated enough to strike back effectively. Is that the best answer to provocations by Vladimir Putin, or could it lead to a wider war? That's later on To the Point. First, this story. Federal appellate court judges are demanding action against what they call an epidemic of misconduct by California district attorneys. Video of a recent hearing of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals went viral in legal circles, showing Judge Alex Kaczynski warning a deputy for State Attorney General Kamala Harris.
Get a hold of the Attorney General, get a hold of the supervisor, and see whether they really want to stick by a conviction. This was obtained by lying prosecutors.
Lying prosecutors. You need some background on the court system to understand just what that means. Mara Dolan is legal affairs writer for the LA Times. Hi, always good to have you with us.
Hi, good to be here.
So we just heard a federal judge talking to a deputy state attorney general about a lying prosecutor who was, in fact, a district attorney. How did all that come together?
The case was on appeal before the Ninth Circuit. The conviction, it was a double murder conviction out of Riverside County, and the state courts had upheld the conviction, even though they determined that a prosecutor got on the stand and gave false testimony about whether a jailhouse informant had sought or received any benefits for testifying against the defendant.
How did it end up in federal court?
Okay, usually cases go through the state system first. California cases through the Court of Appeals and the California Supreme Court, and defendants can then bring a petition for habeas corpus in federal court. And defendants like going to federal court because they usually have much better luck there than in state court. But there are rules now that limit the authority of federal judges to second guess state judges. And at this hearing, you could just hear the frustration of these federal Ninth Circuit judges with the state courts, because people come to them and say, look what happened, and the judges would like to do something, but they can't legally. In this case, Judge Kaczynski, the former chief judge, Ronald Reagan appointee, basically told the attorney general that if you don't do something about it, we're going to name names in an opinion that's going to make you look bad.
Important that our listeners know that the attorney general takes the case on appeal on behalf of the district attorney.
Exactly.
So that's why we have three separate entities involved here. Let's hear a bit more of the exchange between the Deputy Attorney General Kevin Viena and Judge Kaczynski. First, here's Kevin Viena.
I don't think it's proper, Your Honor, and I hope that I made that clear when I began this argument. And I think it's clear that the California courts have
not reassuring that they have taken no steps. I mean, you would think that if they find out about it, Court of Appeal opinion and the magistrate, they would be up in arms and they would have done something about it to show that this is an aberration. But the total silence on this suggests that this is sort of the way it's done. And they got caught this time, but they're going to keep doing it because they have state judges who are willing to look the other way.
So, Mara Dolan, you said they're not supposed to criticize state judges or overrule them, but there they are demonstrating that there is Judge Kaczynski demonstrating that frustration. You said the federal judges are feeling.
They are feeling frustration. They can criticize state judges, but that's what I found remarkable about that hearing was the very strong criticism of state judges. One of the other judges on the panel, basically said it was because state judges are political and they have to run for re-election and they don't want to be overturning convictions. And they're free to criticize all they want, state judges, but it's difficult to overturn a ruling by a state appellate court under new federal rules. They're supposed to defer to the state judges.
Okay. That other judge was Kim Wardlaw, who was appointed by Bill Clinton to the bench. Again, Mara Dolan is with the LA Times. Let me introduce Laurie Levinson, professor of criminal law at the Loyola School of Law. Always good to have you on our program.
It's good to be with you, Warren.
I understand that this video did go viral amongst the legal circles.
It absolutely did. I think prosecutors, defense lawyers, law professors, and the like, everyone took note of what happened in this hearing. And actually, that's rather new that we have that type of insight, being able to see a video of an actual argument. But Judge Kaczynski used this as a platform. He wanted to send a message to a lot of people.
Okay, what's the message to California judges?
I think the message to California judges is don't let prosecutors get away with this type of stuff in your courtroom, that this is very serious. In this particular case, it wasn't just that prosecutors failed to turn over exculpatory evidence or all the information that undercut their informant. A prosecutor actually took the witness stand and lied. And I think the message is that is completely unacceptable. And if it happens, strong action has to be taken.
Okay, so the judges are supposed to take strong action. What's the message to the district attorneys?
The message to the district attorneys is that the judges are watching them. And for those district attorneys who want to win too much, and I really think that that's what's going on here, that they're going to be called on the carpet for it. And one of the things that's going to happen is that the Ninth Circuit will put their names in a published opinion for the whole world to see and mark them as perjurers and unethical.
What then is the message for the California State Attorney General, Kamala Harris, who's going to run for the U.S. Senate?
I think the message for Kamala Harris was you better clean up the system as much as you can, or at least take responsibility. And to her credit, she stepped forward and said that they were going to concede on this habeas petition, and maybe they'll retry him a third time. But she was not going to try to defend the conduct in this case.
Very quickly, back to Maura Dolan. A little bit more about this case. This was, as you indicated, a double murder, but it was strange in that they prosecuted the man who allegedly committed the murder, but not the guy who he said ordered him to do it.
Exactly. And that's why the Ninth Circuit was so skeptical. I did interview the prosecutor. He said he firmly believed it wasn't murder for hire, but they didn't have enough evidence to prosecute the fellow who ordered the murder under legal rules at the time.
So, Laurie Levinson, how common do you think this is? You said that district attorneys don't want cases to fail, obviously, but what about the judges? Was Kim Wardlaw, the federal judge, right that because judges have to run for re-election, they don't want to overturn convictions?
That may be partially right. I don't think we can have a blanket statement against all judges or against all prosecutors. Frankly and thankfully, most of them do the right thing. But we've had a rash of cases recently where they've been dismissed, or we've had this type of situation where the court has called their attention, where prosecutors have not played by the rules. And the message is everybody in the system, whether it's the prosecutor or the judge, has a responsibility. This gentleman may very well be guilty, but there's the integrity of the system to keep in mind.
Maura Dolan, what about the case itself? What was the evidence against the guy who was convicted?
There was quite a bit of evidence against him. A magistrate who reviewed the evidence thought that he had done the shootings, that the prosecutor had proven that he had done the shootings, but had not proven, without this lying jailhouse informant, premeditation, which makes a difference in the crime. He was convicted of premeditated crime based on the informant. What is really interesting, I think, is that judges are supposed to report misconduct to the state bar. Prosecutorial misconduct and incompetent representation by a defense lawyer. And Jerry Ullman, a law professor who ran a state commission several years ago that looked at the criminal justice system, said they investigated this and state judges were not even reporting the names of prosecutors whose convictions had been overturned because of misconduct. And I think until they start reporting these cases or reporting these errant lawyers, you're probably not going to see a lot of change.
There was a report in 2010 examining 707 cases in which the courts did find prosecutorial misconduct during an 11-year period. That was a long time. But of those 707 cases, there was prosecution or there was discipline of the prosecutors in just 6 cases.
Right. It's very rare. I've seen it happen once. I've seen the California Supreme Court name the prosecutor. It was a woman from L.A. And at the end of the court ruling, referred it to the state bar. But you don't typically see it.
And Laurie Levinson, if this happens, frequently. And in this case, the state appellate courts did note that there was prosecutorial misconduct, but let it go by anyway. What would the penalty be for the prosecutor if they'd done something about it?
Well, as Judge Kaczynski pointed out, he thought that this prosecutor should have been criminally charged with perjury. Now, judges don't have the power to bring those charges. There's a separation of powers, and that's up to other prosecutors in the executive function. But I think the message here is that don't show that type of professional courtesy. We had a time in this state where most of our judges came out of the ranks of prosecutors. And the thought was is that people would be very reluctant to criticize their own.
And Maura Dolan, the defendant is not yet off the hook. They may, in Riverside County, prosecute him again.
They said they will prosecute him again. They've said they'll do it, and they also promised to investigate the two prosecutors involved in his case.
Okay. We will see what happens with that one. Obviously, there will be a lot of attention, even though normally these cases don't get much coverage. Maura Dolan with the Los Angeles Times. Thanks to you, Laurie Levinson at Loyola School of Law. Good to have you both on our program.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
You can find the complete video of that Ninth Circuit hearing on our website, kcrw.com/whichwayLA. In a moment, America's first mosque only for women opens up in Los Angeles on Which Way LA.
You're listening to Which Way LA from KCRW. Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/whichwayLA or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can follow us on Twitter at WWLA.
Well, and I'll be back with Which Way LA. Last Friday was the first day of prayer in the Women's Mosque of America, located in downtown Los Angeles. It's available only to women, the first of its kind in the United States. More than 100 women gathered at the nonprofit House of Worship, which promises Muslim women they can bring their whole self. Sanaa Mutalib is co-president. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, it's my pleasure to be with you today.
Why is this needed?
Well, the reason this is needed is, you know, it's for women, it's always an issue of access to spaces. This space is meant to be an empowering space. You can think of it as like a women's college. Women's colleges are often thought of as places where women can go to gain scholarship and leadership skills and also a sense of sisterhood. So this space is meant to be a complementary space to existing mosques where women can really go and engage with each other and really learn from one another. And we also see this as kind of a return to our history. In Islamic history and Islamic tradition, there's actually quite a strong tradition of women leaders and women scholars, and we're really trying to return to that with the space.
Back to traditional mosques, or mosques as we think of them, where men and women are separated, are women not given adequate spaces or spaces that encourage sisterhood, as you described it?
You know, it really depends from mosque to mosque. Every mosque has its own culture. And, you know, in many mosques, there women are accommodated, and they're accommodated quite well. However, I think our space, what we're trying to create, is something really, truly unique because it focuses on the female perspective, and it really gives women an ability to learn from one another and really gain leadership skills. And I do want to stress that though the prayers are open only to women, our classes, our seminars, our workshops are open to both men and women because it's not only about increasing female access to spaces. It's also about increasing everyone's access to the female perspective on Islam and Islamic texts.
So when you hear the word, use the word space, you're using it in a very broad sense, not just in terms of the physical location. How did it go the first night of prayer?
You know, it was wonderful. It was an incredibly emotional and joyous experience. I think any woman who was there could tell you that it was really something special. The sense of community, the sense of sisterhood that was there was really something unique. And yes, when I refer to space, you know, it's so much broader than just a physical space. The Women's Mosque of America actually does not have a physical space. We're very much a pop-up mosque, if you would like to call it. It's more of a community, and our goal is to kind of go around Southern California, whether it be Orange County or the West Side or the East Side of LA, and to create that sense of community for women, regardless of where they are in the LA area.
So the first one was in downtown Los Angeles, but others may occur elsewhere.
Yes, that's correct. The first one was at the Pico Union Multi-Faith Center in downtown Los Angeles, and our plan is to kind of rotate our location on a regular basis.
Will you be doing this once a week?
It won't be once a week at the moment. Our plan currently is to do it once a month. I'm sure, as you can imagine, it's quite an undertaking to even do that at this point. So once a month is what we're going for. And again, because it's a complimentary space, we think that once a month right now is a good balance. Women can come here and experience this community once a month and hopefully go back to their local mosques and still be engaged in their local community.
Sanaa Mutallab, again, co-president of the Women's Mosque of America. Let me introduce Jihad Turk. He is president of the Bayan Claremont Islamic Graduate School, also an imam and a religious advisor at the Islamic Center of Southern California. Good to have you back on our program.
Nice to be back, Warren.
Tell us your reaction to this and that of the Muslim community in general.
Well, my personal reaction was very supportive. I know many of the organizers of the mosque and have for many years. In fact, the woman who gave the sermon, the first sermon, is not only a longtime member at the Islamic Center where I served as imam, but also is one of our adjunct faculty at Bayan Claremont teaching a course in Islamic leadership and spirituality. Her name is Adina Lekovich. My reaction has been very supportive from the beginning, because although the Islamic Center of Southern California is particularly inclusive and accommodating for women, there still is room for growth there. But many other mosques have a lot farther to go to give access to women to not just spiritual engagement, but also educational opportunities and programming. And simply, you know, having a space that encourages women to form strong bonds with one another and support one another in forming community. However, there were some voices that I heard from some of my colleagues and fellow imams here in Southern California, words of concern that maybe this is going to diminish the involvement of women in the community and somehow take away from the growth and development of the local mosques. However, listening to Sanaa, I think she preemptively addressed many of those concerns, and they do have a wonderful website that has some frequently asked questions that try to ameliorate some of these concerns.
Have there been conservatives who say this is not traditional?
You know, it's interesting, Warren, because when the image of Islam and Muslims is that women are somehow a second-class citizen, et cetera, or diminutive and silent and marginalized, but because of the religion. But what's fascinating to discover when you look at Islamic history and the precedent set by the Prophet Muhammad is that women were empowered by him at the time in a break from the Arab chauvinistic male-dominated culture at that time. Islam came in and empowered women. Now, that empowerment didn't necessarily sustain itself over the many centuries since then, but the precedent is there. And some of the conservative scholars, they all agreed. They said, yes, Islamic scholarship, and they quoted the main schools of law and the main sources, say, yes, women can lead prayer, women can teach and do all of the things that are being taught at the or that are being conducted at the Women's Mosque of America. The only controversy, I think, came about surrounding the question of whether women can lead the Friday sermon per se, but it was more of a technical issue. The voices of concern were not predicated on what is permissible in Islamic tradition and law, but what is normative, what is it was a question of wisdom or skepticism of what is their motive. But I think the Women's Mosque of America has done a great job in trying to address those concerns and are continuing to be active on social media. I think Sanaa and I this morning were exchanging some comments addressing some of the concerns on Facebook and other social media.
I know that Muslim women in the United States are second only to Jewish women in terms of education level and professionalism. Were there those, Jihad Turk, who said that this just further isolates women and makes them secondary and second-class citizens?
What was funny was I got contacted by someone who is active in women's issues and leadership in Southern California, a woman, and she was upset by this idea and thought that this was somehow a segregation of women, separate but not equal, and somehow diminishing the role of women in the community and justifying the segregation. In other words, if women remove themselves from the community, then they're ceding the space to of the local mosque to just men. But I think that that was also predicated on a misconception. That was addressed by the website.
Zunah Mutalib, let me go back to you. I don't want to let us men dominate this conversation. How do you think this will affect Muslim men?
You know, I think that this initiative is something that will benefit the community as a whole, including Muslim men. You know, we really view Muslim men as our partners and our brothers in this process. I would like to point out that two of our board members are actually men. And as Jihad mentioned, he has been one of our greatest advisors and assets and has been one of our greatest supporters. So this entire process has been undertaken very much in step with men, with their support, with their encouragement. And I've had many men come up to me and say that they're so excited by this space, especially because they themselves can benefit from the classes and the seminars and the workshops that we hope to offer in the future. And even just for the prayers, which they themselves cannot attend, so many men have told me that they're so excited for their wives, their mothers, their sisters, and their daughters. Actually, some of our most heartfelt messages of support have come from fathers who have told me that they're so excited that a space like this now exists for their daughters. And also even from the older generation, from imams of established mosques, we've really received some wonderful messages of support because they see the benefit of in this, the benefit for the entire community and not just for the women in the community.
Despite the separation of men and women in traditional mosques, does the Quran promote gender equality?
Yes, I believe so, absolutely. If you know, pick up the Quran and take a look at exactly what it says and read it in context, it is very clear to me that gender equality is one of really the underlying foundational principles of the Quran. That's something that I realized in my own life when I picked it up and really read it in a language that I understood when I was a law student. I was simultaneously taking constitutional law, and it was striking to me how many similarities I saw in terms of how much the Quran and the Constitution emphasize equality for all, for the races and for the sexes as well.
Jihad Turk, would you agree with that?
Completely.
Enough said. So quickly, if you will, Sanaa Mutalib, we don't have a lot of time left, but elaborate a little bit more on the fact that boys as well as girls will be part of these services.
Absolutely. Our services are open to children, including boys 12 and under. And really, that's for this to be an inclusive space for mothers as well. And we also hope that, you know, the young boys can see their mothers and their sisters praying together, giving sermons and leading, and that that will have an impact on them and how they view women throughout their life.
One thing, as I understand it, is you do not require the hijab, the headscarf in the mosque for women?
We have a come-as-you-are policy, and the reason we have that policy is because we want all women from all schools of thought and level of practice to feel welcome. And so that is officially our policy, that women should come as they feel most comfortable.
So you're open to women who are not Muslims?
We actually, during our first prayer service, had a wonderful showing by the interfaith community, and we welcome our sisters in faith to join us at any time.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being on our program. Sanaa Mutaleb, again, co-president of the Women's Mosque of America, had the inaugural prayer last Friday in downtown Los Angeles. It's going to be a once-a-month traveling affair. And Jihad Turk, who's president of the Bayonne Claremont Islamic Graduate School and religious advisor at the Islamic Center of Southern California, thanks to you as well. It's great to have both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Warren.
Remember, you can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, can U.S. aid to Ukraine stop Vladimir Putin? On To the Point.